Ara? Se sent? Sí?
This reminds me of home. At MIT, which of course is an engineering school, the sound system always breaks down in graduation for some reason. Well, I was talking yesterday about externalist theories of meaning. We're now at the heart of the topic of the theory of meaning and reference. The theory of meaning has two aspects. So there's reference, the relation between, the alleged relation between words and things, and there's meaning, which is supposed to be whatever it is that fixes reference, the framework that comes from Frege. The externalist theory of meaning holds that meaning is not in the mind, and the fixation of reference is not in the mind. What a word refers to depends on first social factors, and second, real-world factors. And since the reference depends on those factors, obviously it can't be in the mind. This is by now the prevailing theory. It yields what's called a notion of wide content or broad content, meaning reference, and a mode of fixing broad content, which would be the meaning. There's then a debate that goes on. It's taken for granted that this has been established. So if you look at the literature, you find background assumption. Of course, these things exist. And then a debate proceeds as to whether there is also something called narrow content, which would be the internalist version, and more or less a traditional version, a conception of meaning as something that's in the head. So according to an internalist version, you know what you mean. According to an externalist version, you don't know what you mean, because it's determined by the outside world and by the future discoveries of science and by societies of which you in which you play a part. This goes along with the idea that, as I've quoted from various people, each person has a partial and generally erroneous knowledge of their own language. And the language is what it is, even if nobody knows it. Similarly, the meaning of a word is what it is, even if nobody knows it. And typically, nobody will know it, because the actual meaning will depend on the future discoveries of science, the real-world factors. Well, this theory is... we might, first of all, ask what is being a theory is a theory about something. So what is this theory about? The idea is that these external factors, these social and real-world factors, provide us with the real meaning, the real notion of meaning and reference. And then the question arises, what do we mean by the real notion? Well, there are two possible interpretations of this. One is that we're trying to capture the common sense notion, the notion in ordinary usage, what's called grandma's view. So that's one possibility. It's the real notion of meaning because that's grandma's notion. That's the notion that ordinary people have. The second possible interpretation is that it's the true notion. That is, it's the notion of meaning that is accurate about the world, tells you the truth about the world. It's the notion of meaning that will arise in the ultimate best science about the world. Okay, so it's the true notion, part of science, and it's never been made very clear which of those two is the intended target of the approach, but probably the first. Grandma's view, folk psychology. What the philosopher is trying to capture in the theory of meaning. Well, it doesn't seem that could be correct, for one simple reason, because in ordinary language, there is no notion of reference as a relation between words and things. Therefore, there can't be any notion of broad content or narrow content or anything else. There is a notion refer, but that is used for people, like most of the intentional language, understand, and you know, and so on. These are all referring as an action that people do. In any language I've ever heard of, certainly in English, people refer to things using words or gestures or whatever, but the gestures don't refer and the words don't refer, except maybe very derivatively. So I can say, and in fact you can refer to things without even mentioning them. You can say that John was referring to London when he was complaining about the traffic, or when he was telling us what a wonderful performance of Richard II he saw. He didn't mention London or have any phrase indicating London. He could perfectly well have been referring to London. We might say, sometimes you can speak of words referring, but more or less indirectly. You can say, John was using the word London to refer to Paris, let's say. Maybe out of perversity or something like that. That's certainly possible, and then we could go on to say, in John's last statement, the word London referred to Paris. Okay, now we have a relation between words and things, but it's highly derivative. The main usage, the core usage, is has to do with people and what they do, just as in as all the intentional vocabulary, thinking, understanding, interpreting, everything. These are things people do. That's the way language works. I've never heard of a language that has any other character. In fact, when Frege established the subject, he had to make up new technical terms to capture what he wanted. So the technical terms, Bedeutung and Sinn, which are variously translated in various languages, this one is the one that's supposed to be reference, and this one's the one that's supposed to be meaning. But he had to make up, of course they are words of German, but he explicitly gave them special technical meanings because they don't have those meanings in German. And when they're translated into English as reference and sense or whatever, they are technical terms. They have what a technical term has whatever meaning you give to it. There's no debate about what it means. You know, if somebody defines momentum, we no longer have debate about what it means for them. They've told us. We also have no intuitions about technical terms. You can't have any intuitions about angular momentum, let's say, or undecidability in the technical sense. You can't talk about what it means to you or something. That doesn't make any sense. It doesn't mean anything to you. It means exactly what it was stipulated to mean. So notions like reference and fixation of reference, if reference is held to be a relationship between words and things, whatever value the notion has, it can't be part of Grandma's view, because she doesn't have any such notion, nor does anybody. You can understand the notion. I mean, it's an intelligible notion. You can make it up, and then comes the question whether there exists such a relationship. Does there exist a relationship between words and things, as is claimed? Once you can define the notion all right, but that doesn't establish the relationship. You can define all kinds of notions. You still have to show that the relationship exists. Maybe it does, maybe it doesn't. but in any event, it cannot be that the intent of this inquiry or effort is to establish folk psychology. In fact, if it were an attempt to establish the ideas of folk psychology, one would wonder what the point is. After all, that's a topic in cultural anthropology. It's unclear what it has to do with philosophy. Just as the study of people's ordinary conceptions of the nature of the natural world is a topic in cultural anthropology. It's ethnoscience, and you know, different groups of people have different interpretations of the way the world works and so on. It's a fine subject, you know, nothing wrong with ethnoscience. Maybe it's even illuminating. But it's... I see. Shall I use them? Yeah. Are you having trouble hearing? Maybe I don't need it. Can you hear me back there without it? sure to strangle myself. Are we okay? Let me get the signal from back there. Okay. Is this working or? I can't get any indication. Is this working? Is it working now? I see. Well, can you hear me in the back? Yeah? Okay. So you want me to keep using this anyway? You don't care? I should keep using it. Okay. Yeah. I should keep using it. Okay. Even if it's not working. Yeah. Okay. Well, let's turn then to the second possibility. This is that this theory is an attempt to find the truth about the world. That sounds incomprehensible. I don't know what that means even. What truth about the world are we trying to discover? Maybe one can make some sense of that, but I think an explanation would at least have to be given. What aspect of science are we now investigating? I mean, if you're doing biology, you sort of understand what you're doing. What aspect of science are we in? Is this one better? Yeah? You still want me to keep this thing? Yeah, okay. You know, the real autocrats of the modern age are the television people and the photographers and so on. So for anybody knows that. Well, let's imagine, let's grant that we have some understanding of this, although I don't think it's obvious that we do, but let's grant it for the sake of argument, and compare the wider broad content and the notion's narrow content. We have a phenomenon, some phenomenon or other, say Bert and the arthritis, and we can give an explanation for the phenomenon in terms of broad content, and we can also give an explanation in terms of narrow content. Suppose that works out. Well, then the explanation in terms of narrow content wins. It's the one that would be preferred for pure methodological reasons. One reason is that the explanation in terms of narrow content is clearly part of science. Therefore, it's naturalistic, and it therefore carries no burden of proof. Narrow content is, remember, it's a scientific question, a question of biology, ultimately, to discover, if this is a child, what class of linguistic expressions get formed in the child's mind via the generative procedure. And if indeed there is a notion, if we can give an account, narrow content would involve whatever the semantic properties of this are. This is a collection of properties, say phonetic and structural and semantic properties. And if there are semantic properties, which we can think of as being instructions for use, analogously, phonetic properties are instructions to the articulatory perceptual system. If indeed there are semantic properties, that is, there is an internalist notion of meaning, a notion of narrow content, then that one, and if that notion of meaning can be used to explain the phenomena, then we don't even look at other notions like externalist ones, because this is the methodologically preferable one. One, it's part of the world, clearly. It's a notion that arises from scientific inquiry, naturalistic inquiry, with all the problems of getting the truth and so on, but it carries no burden, carries no further burden. In contrast, the notion of an externalist notion would carry a heavy burden of justification. It is not a naturalistic concept. It's a concept in part of sociology, and it's also got the problem that since real world factors enter, that means that the notion of external content depends on everything in the on all of science. Okay, it's to discover the meaning of a particular word, say water, you have to, in principle, all of science is relevant to that. So it's a highly holistic notion, so holistic that it's completely comprehensive, includes everything. A concept that, in order to be fixed, requires knowledge of everything is not a naturalistic concept in any serious sense. Insofar as social factors are involved, we're really pretty much at sea. There's no indication of how social factors are delimited, what are the right communities, and so on. So if it's a naturalistic concept at all, it's a very high order one. Maybe like a concept of sociology or something like that. And a concept of biology always wins if it is equally explanatory. Furthermore, on the one hand, the internalist has secondly, there's no far simpler. I mean, the externalist notion is it involves any kind of social interaction that might be involved in a person's deciding to use a word one or another way, and any inquiry into the world that might tell us the truth about what the word actually refers to. We're now granting that we can make some sense of this idea. Thirdly, the internalist notion appears to be a prerequisite for the externalist one. Now that's worth thinking about for a minute. The question is, can you even present the externalist notion, the notion of wide content, without presupposing an internalist notion? Okay. First, if the answer is that you can't, then surely if the internalist notion alone suffices to provide a description, you won't go on to the externalist one for that reason alone. Well, is that the case? Let's take, say, Bert and the arthritis again. And remember the way the situation was set up. Bert goes to the doctor and says he has arthritis in his ankle and his thigh, and the doctor explains to him that arthritis is just used for joints, and he doesn't have it in his ankle because he has a sprained ankle. But Bert went to the doctor with some kind of concept in mind. He had a word, arthritis, which had some semantic features. According to Tyler Burge, the wrong ones, okay, whatever that means. But in any event, he had some semantic features. He didn't go to the doctor with the word arthritis. He didn't go to the doctor and say, I have glub, some made-up word, in my thigh. He went and said, I had arthritis in my thigh, and arthritis had a specific meaning. The doctor had to correct him because he had semantic features. If he didn't have any semantic features, the doctor couldn't have corrected him. Same in the case of Hilary Putnam and Elm and Beach. Elm and Beach weren't just nonsense syllables for Putnam. In that case, he wouldn't have known how to go to an expert. Elm and Beach meant, big tree or something. So they had some features. And in fact, if you look through the literature, you'll discover that in all the cases, the discussion begins. It's a descriptive account of how meaning is fixed. It starts by the assumption that there's some initial array of semantic features that the terms have, maybe the wrong ones according to this theory. Well, is that eliminable? Could you? You go to the doctor and say, I'm not feeling well, the doctor doesn't correct you. See, this is a question of how you fix the meaning of a term. The idea here always is to show that the actual meaning of the terms we use, we might not know. We might be wrong about, because the actual meaning is determined by experts and the reality of the world. If you go to the doctor and say, I'm not feeling well, he doesn't correct you. It's true, you're not feeling well. You use the terms exactly accurately. You didn't have anything more to say about it, but there's no meaning to be corrected. So you don't engage. If you go to the doctor and you say, I'm not feeling well, you don't engage in a discussion about the meanings of words. On the other hand, if you go to the doctor and say, I have arthritis in my thigh, according to this story, the doctor, you do enter into a discussion about the meanings of words. The doctor tells you you didn't understand the word arthritis. Okay. So sure, we can not have anything in mind, but that's, yeah. I'm sorry, I didn't know. A comment?
Orders.
Stop. So the child might block the semantic features, block the semantic features and go straight to the real world. Well, the question is whether it's conceivable. Is it possible to have a notion of island in which expressions will lack semantic features altogether, and then you turn to the world or to society to fill in the semantic features? It's not so simple to construct such an idea. How, if you have no semantic features at all, how do you approach the problem of adding semantic features? How do you do that if you have no semantic features at all? Do you have the concept of semantic features? I mean, is it that you've got a concept of semantic features, but you never fill them in? Well, if you do, there has to be some structure to that concept. There have to be certain things that are possible semantic features and others that are not possible semantic features. So in order to build up, this is a theoretically possible account. It just seems to me hopelessly unpersuasive. You'd have to assume that in universal grammar, in the child's mind, there is some characterization of the semantic features, okay? So in the child's mind, there is some characterization of the class of possible semantic features, just as there must be a characterization of the class of phonetic features. If there's no such classification, if there's no initial categorization of that type, you'll never pick up any of them, no matter what evidence you use. Okay, that's just, you know, ordinary logic. Unless there's enough structure to tell you what counts as a semantic feature, you'll never find any of them. So we have to assume that the child has the notion of semantic feature, has some theory of semantic features in the mind, in some form or other, but doesn't use it. Okay. Rather, the child develops a concept of language which never uses those features, and then turns to others in some fashion, or turns to the actual world, say to the future discoveries of science, to fill in the features. I don't even know what this means. I mean, obviously the child doesn't turn to the future discovery of science to fill in the features. When you say that the child turns to others to fill in the features, how is that any different from saying the child uses the data to add features to the items in the lexicon? That seems just a way of restating the internalist picture. I mean, let's try the same thing on the phonetic side. Suppose somebody came along and said, look, I have a new theory of acquisition of the sound structure of language. The child, of course, has a theory of universal phonetics, has some kind of characterization of the possible sound features, but the child doesn't use them. The child just creates a lexical item without any phonetic features, but all the other features, and then turns to the world, let's say to what other people are doing, to add the phonetic features. That doesn't seem to be any different than saying the child uses the data to build up lexical items that have phonetic and semantic features. It's a funny way of saying that simple thing. There seems no way, as far as I can see, of avoiding an internalist notion in constructing the concept of external content, any more than there would be a way of developing some corresponding phonological conception. You might try to think about it and see if you can imagine a way in which the notion externalist content, wide content, can even be intelligibly described without presupposing that an operation of this kind has taken place. That is, that the child has looked at data and constructed items which include various properties, including semantic properties. Now, it would be intelligible to say the child has the wrong semantic properties, just as it would be intelligible to say the child has the wrong phonetic properties. When I say intelligible, I don't think it's the right view. I don't think it makes any sense. But you can, at least it's coherent. But such a view is always based on a prior internalist account, based on narrow content, and according to this view, the wrong narrow content. If that's, I should, there's a, let's take an analogous argument. I mentioned this is a kind of problem that arises all the time. Notice that if this is, if the internalist account is a prerequisite for the externalist one, if it's simpler, which is obvious, if it's naturalistic, whereas the other is not, which is also obvious, then going back to my original statement, if you can give a naturalistic, an internalist account, it wins for those reasons. Now, in the case of, say, Bert and the arthritis, there's a perfectly fine internalist account. Bert went to the doctor with his own lexical item, arthritis, maybe pronounced it differently, maybe said arthritis. Use the word. And Bert would then introduce some modifications in his eye language. And since this is a very peripheral part of the eye language, you know, it's not like the system of anaphora or something, which you can't tamper with. This is a part of the, Bert could simply decide, in effect, to drop this linguistic expression, to throw that word out of his eye language, and introduce a new word. We're picking up new words all the time. You know? And he'd say, okay, I'll pick up a new word which pronounces arthritis. He used to pronounce it with an ear over here, you know, phonetically this. Now he'll pronounce it with this. And this new word will have a different phonology, and it'll have a different semantics. It'll now refer to you know, diseases of the joints. That's just like learning a new word. I mean, we know that people can learn. So in fact, Bert, and you don't have to go beyond narrow content and eye language to a lexicon, a new connection, a new time all through your life. You know. And maybe you throw out some old word. You're not going to use it anymore. Well, that's a completely internal, and then we ask, why did Bert do it? Well, you know, you go into authority structures or whatever. That's a completely internalist account of that interaction. And the no completely accurate. It doesn't lose anything. In fact, it's probably the best account you can think of that, of what happened. Same in the case of elm and beech. If I go to my Italian gardener, give him the Latin name, and he tells me which is the elm and which is the beech, I can decide to amplify my, to amplify my lexicon, to introduce new items into my lexicon, which include the features that he told me about. I don't have to get into the absurdity of thinking that he's part of my linguistic community, which he certainly isn't, because he's a monolingual Italian. It's a completely internalist account. It appeals to nothing more than ordinary acquisition of vocabulary items through experience. In this case, through experience plus decision. But that doesn't change anything. So there is a perfectly fine, and if you run through the literature, you'll find, I think, that in every case of alleged social factors and meaning, there's a perfectly straightforward internalist account that makes use of the social factors, of course, but doesn't make use of any notion of broad content. Well, since the notion of broad content requires narrow content as a prerequisite, presupposes narrow content, is far more complex, and is non-naturalistic, there's no reason to introduce it, at least for social factors. So it would seem. So at least that that aspect of the externalist aspect here seems to have to be dismissible. We don't need it. That's the aspect that had to do with common language, common public language. And that's just as well, because as I said, that's an incoherent notion anyhow. So anything that appealed to it is, you know, happy to get rid of. There are analogous arguments in other areas. Take, say, Davidson's story about constructing a passing theory. So we have a communication situation. We have an interpreter. And the interpreter hears, you know, here's Mary over here and listens to Mary's sentences. And the interpreter, Peter, constructs a passing theory using any information at all to try to figure out what Mary's saying. Okay, and the passing theory could be anything. You could use knowledge about Mary's background, anything that might be relevant. And then this passing theory looks at that evidence and comes out with some interpretation. That's the story. Well, the question that might be asked is there... just look at the question of prerequisites. Does this approach presuppose the existence of a parser, let's say? A parser is a device that takes in data. Parser. And give some kind of structural account of it. Okay. The structural account that it gives is, of course, based on whatever I language is internal to the parser. So, for example, if I hear you speaking, one of the things that I do is assign a phonetic representation and a division into words and into phrases and so on and so forth. And also assign meanings and so on. I do it in terms of my I language. Of course, that's not the only thing I do, since first I have to overcome the problem that your I language is different from mine. So I also have to work out this class of modifications, which will allow me to interpret your expressions as some parallel expressions of mine. But the question is whether the Davidsonian theory, that you construct a passing theory, can be even described, can be even presented coherently, without assuming that somewhere along the line a parser enters into the picture, something that assigns structure to utterances on the basis of a person's eye language. Well, I won't go into that, but try it. Try to construct the theory of the interpreter that doesn't presuppose that at some stage in the process you're actually assigning structure to utterances in terms of your own eye language. I think it's impossible to do that. Sort of leave it as an exercise to the reader. See if you can construct an account. Davidson doesn't tell you how this happens, but see if you can construct an account of the interpreter that doesn't introduce this notion at some point in the along the line. I don't think that that's possible. An analogous question also arises constantly in the case of the standard picture of fixation of eye language. So take this picture. This picture is always, if presented accurately, is presented in an idealized form. You assume that the data is homogeneous. Okay, so it's not half Italian and half English, let's say. Or it doesn't involve contradictory information, you know, like contradictory phonetics, let's say. typically, one says that we're studying the acquisition of language in an idealized homogeneous speech community, where everybody speaks exactly the same way, and they pronounce things the same way, and they have the same meanings and the same structures and so on. And we ask, what eye language would be produced in a child's mind in such a community? Okay, that's what this is really a description of. Well, a very common critique is that this is an illegitimate idealization, because the real world doesn't have homogeneous communities, which is perfectly true. It doesn't. There's no such thing as a homogeneous community. And there are certainly, if the critique that something's an illegitimate idealization, of course, has to be taken seriously. There are illegitimate idealizations. So, for example, it can be argued, and I think, that classical economics involves an illegitimate idealization in that it studies market systems without looking at questions of power. And that's a critique. You know, you've got to ask, is it right or wrong? I think probably. The question is whether, in this case, it's an illegitimate idealization. And here we turn again to the matter of presupposition and prerequisites. That is there a possible account of acquisition of language in real-world heterogeneous situations that doesn't presuppose this account? Well, just think what such an account would have to be. First, we ask question number one. Suppose somebody says, I think this is an illegitimate idealization. Then my question to him would be this. One, is it possible for a child to learn a language in a homogeneous situation? Is that a possibility? Okay. In other words, is it necessary for language learning that you hear conflicting, incoherent data? Is that a necessary feature of language learning, that the data that you hear contradict other data? Well, that's absurd. I mean, obviously, it's not a prerequisite for language learning that you hear conflicting data. It's not a prerequisite for learning a language that you hear both Italian and English intermingled, let's say. I don't think anybody would claim that. Well, if so, it is certainly possible for a child to learn language if the data is homogeneous, consistent, in other words. It's possible to learn language from consistent data. If it is possible, then there's got to be some property that the child has in his mind, call it the property P, which enables the child to learn language in a homogeneous situation, or would enable the child to learn language in a homogeneous situation if it existed. So we've now established that there is such a property in the mind. Well, next question. Does language learning in the normal situation make use of P? P plus other things. Suppose you are faced in a real-world situation with conflicting data. Does the child make use of the property P, which we see must be there, or does it just not use it at all? Well, there's two possibilities. Either it makes use of P plus other techniques to get around the fact that data is conflicting, in which case P is a prerequisite for the complex, the idealized model is a prerequisite for the complex situation, or else one would have to argue that the child doesn't use P. In other words, human beings have this funny property in their heads that would enable them to learn language in a homogeneous situation, but they never use it. Okay. Just like sort of sitting there. Complex, property, UG and so on, is there in the brain, but it's never put to use. In actual situations, they do something else, always. Well, that's not a physical impossibility. I mean, an organism might have some complex capacity that it never uses, but it's pretty outlandish. And if you think that this is an illegitimate idealization, you're committed to one of those two views, either that it's impossible to learn language unless the data is conflicting, or else that a child has the capacity to learn language under such a situation, but it's never been used in the history of the human species. Well, either of those two assumptions is too ridiculous to take seriously, from which it follows that not only is the idealization legitimate, but it's presupposed in all actual work. Now, a lot of questions have come up about sociolinguistics a couple of times. This is a typical case. Sociolinguistics studies things like the acquisition of language in non-homogeneous situations. And often sociolinguists claim that they reject the idealizations of the linguist. But I think it's clear that they don't reject them, unless they want to commit themselves to one of these two absurd ideas. I mean, unless they want to commit themselves to one or the other of these absurd ideas, they presuppose the linguist's conceptions tacitly. And then that tells you how you should do the work, namely in the reasonable way. You should ask how the property P, the property that enables you to use language, to learn language in a homogeneous situation, is used in accord with other, alongside of other talents and other capacities to deal with the real world situation. Same in the case of the interpreter. You'll ask how the parser, which is based on the operation that assigns structures based on the I language, how is that used in more complex situations to yield interpretations? The argument over there is pretty much the same, except for one difference. The part that's the same says, if you're interested in external content, you would ask how internal content is used to establish external content. Same reasons, it's a prerequisite, so how do you use it? The difference is that in these two cases, it's clear that you're talking about at least something. I mean, interpretation does go on. Language learning under situations of conflict does go on, but it's not at all clear that establishment of external content goes on. However, if it does, if people actually are picking up vocabulary items and modifying them and so on the basis of the real world and the social factors, then an account of that will have to presuppose and build upon the notion of narrow content in any event. So the debate as to whether there is narrow content makes no sense. It's being presupposed. It's like a debate in sociolinguistics about whether there exists, whether the linguist's concept even exists. Well, they have to because they're presupposing them, unless they want to commit themselves to absurdity. This type of argument applies over and over again. It's worth thinking about it, and I think it's quite accurate. Well, in this case, we appear to have an internalist account, purely internalist account, of the social interactions, which makes no appeal to things like common language or anything else. That account is preferable on all grounds and indeed seems to be presupposed in the externalist account. So that would seem to settle that issue. There's a kind of an epistemological priority to the internalist notion. You have to have it before you build up to the externalist one, just as there's an epistemological priority to the notion of acquisition of language in homogeneous speech communities. You need it in order to build up to the higher notion. And probably, though it's not certain, the same is true about parsers and interpreters. If so, it seems that we are not forced to move to the study of everything in order to deal with the notion of meaning. At least with regard to social factors, it's perfectly possible to keep to a completely internalist account. Now, I'll come back to the harder question of real-world factors in a minute. I think it is harder, more puzzling in certain ways. But let me make it clear what I'm not saying. I'm not suggesting that naturalistic accounts are a possible alternative to the standard externalist accounts. I'm not saying that. Rather, I think that the externalist accounts cannot be seriously considered. They can't be seriously entertained, at least with regard to social factors, because there is a naturalistic account, and secondly, because the basis for the externalist account, the notion of common public language or community or whatever, has not been clarified. So it's hand-waving. It's hand-waving, and it's unnecessary. So it's not that the naturalistic account is an alternative that we can place alongside the standard theories. Rather, it's the only theory. The standard ones just don't deserve being considered, at least with regard to social factors. Let me repeat something I said before. I'm also not suggesting that we use the concept idiolect instead of language or dialect in the sense of common language. An idiolect in all this literature, the term idiolect is used to refer to the particular system, the particular speech, the grammar or the set of rules or something, for a particular person in particular situations, particular style of speech for a particular person. And that notion is also not of much use. It's not an I language. It's not an I language because it was developed in the person's head in the actual world. And the actual world is one of heterogeneous speech communities, which involve conflicting data and so on and so forth. So what has gotten into your head is some horrible mess based on the property P, that is, the property that allows you to select an I language under homogeneous conditions, plus whatever historical accidents and accidents of personal history and whatever have given this thing in your head. I mean, there's something there, but it's certainly not an I language. And the thing that's there is about as of much interest to science as the flight of a feather on a windy day or something. Just some mess, not worth looking at. What you want to look at if you want to understand things, including what's going on in the real world, is what is called the idealized concept, the concept of I language as it would arise under homogeneous conditions. And the notion idealized, as I think I mentioned before, can be misleading. Idealized means real in the sciences. Idealization carries you to reality, to the elements out of which the real complexity is constituted. That's what idealization's for. If idealization is, you can be mistaken. Maybe it's an illegitimate idealization. But if you carried out idealization correctly, you're not dealing with an ideal world. You're dealing with the real world. The reality of the world is those hidden truths that we can only discover by idealization. That is, by throwing away complexity that's messing up the situation. That's, in a way, the major insight of the Galilean revolution. Galileo, for example, was criticized for studying things like balls rolling down inclined planes. Well, who cares about balls rolling down inclined planes? That doesn't happen. What happens is balls roll down mountainsides and so on. He had to make an effort, a propaganda effort, to convince people that if you wanted to understand the real world, you had to look at highly idealized situations. Balls rolling down frictionless planes, something which can't even exist physically. And it's only after that intellectual wrench has been made that you enter the world of natural science. That wrench hasn't been made in most fields. So, especially in these fields, it's still pre-scientific. in the sense that the understanding that to get at reality you have to idealize is considered quite controversial in the study of humans. And that's a sign of their primitiveness. another sign. Well, okay, so much for the social factors. What about the real world factors? That's a tricky issue. And there's been a lot of sophisticated work on it. I'll give a couple of cases. Again, we have to ask the same question. When we look at the real world factors, are we trying to capture grandma's view or the true theory? And we have the same problems. If we're trying to capture grandma's view, she doesn't have any view about reference, so therefore she can't have a view about real world factors. If we're trying to develop the true theory of reference, it's unclear what we're doing. It's unclear what the topic of study is, what the empirical conditions of this inquiry are. It's not like trying to explain the truth about perception or something. Maybe we can learn something by looking at the... Maybe we can clarify this issue by looking at the matter of perception. Because, in fact, these arguments have been applied not just to language, but to psychology generally. That is, it's commonly believed that all of psychology, not just language, has to be externalist. Okay? Has to deal with real-world factors. We're now dropping the social factors and looking just at the real-world factors, and it is widely argued and widely assumed that all of psychology, not just the language part, is crucially wedded to real-world factors. So take the take perceptual psychology, say vision. A common view today, you know, applying the same externalist thinking, is that the psychologist studying vision must take into account the real nature of the things being seen. Okay, and the argument. This, if we have the sentence, John sees a tree, okay, and that's what's being studied in the study of vision, the fact that John sees a tree or something simpler like, say, a cube in motion or something. See is what's called a success word. You don't see something unless it's really there. If it's not really there, and you may think you see it, but you have an illusion, okay. This is not so obvious, but it's claimed that in normal language, and there's at least something to it, see is a success word. You can't say, I saw a tree if there wasn't a tree there. You may have thought you saw a tree, but you didn't see the tree. That's what an illusion is, when you think you see something, but it isn't there. Well, since see is a success term, and visual psychology is studying seeing, then it's got to be externalist. It has to take account of the thing that is being seen and its nature. Now, for internalist psychology, in contrast, that's the internalist theory of perception is a study of what goes on between the retina and the brain. Doesn't matter what's out there. Okay, internalist psychology asks what happens when a signal hits the retina and gets interpreted in the brain. Whatever caused the signal to hit the retina. But externalist psychology must look at what caused the thing that hit the retina, because you didn't really see the tree unless it was there. For example, if somebody stimulated your retina, if there was a way of stimulating the retina with the same signals that are provided, say, by a cube rotating in space, then you would have in your head exactly the picture of that you get when you see a cube rotating in space, but you wouldn't have seen it because there was no cube rotating in space. Okay, it was just some mad scientist stimulating your retina. Okay, so for studying, so an externalist theory of perception would require and insist, in fact, that psychology must be the study of the relation between things and percepts, whereas an internalist theory of perception says psychology is the study of the relation between retinal images and percepts. Now notice that an internalist psychology has no problem with the fact that see is a success word. It just says, I'm not studying seeing. Seeing is something that people do. I'm studying the way in which they do it. I'm studying the mechanisms that enter into what people do in the real world. And those mechanisms lie between the retina and the brain. And then when I want to talk about, you know, how people find their way in the world, I'm going to add all sorts of other stuff. but I'm studying this part of the process, that's psychology. Well, it's commonly argued, it's argued particularly by Tyler Burge again, series of articles, as has have others, Martin Davies, who expected to be here but couldn't make it, and others have argued that actual psychology, actual visual psychology, is externalist. So they're concerned, they're interested particularly in work in the David Marr school. David Marr was a neurophysiologist who pretty much opened up large parts of the contemporary theory of vision by developing models of the visual process that carry it from stimuli up till not quite percepts, but these sort of partial images of percepts. And these models had neurophysiological reality and some success in explanation, and they set off a big study. It's one of the main parts of the theory of vision. So Burge and Davies and others have argued that, in fact, if you look at the work in the Marr school, it is externalist. Therefore, psychology is externalist, as it ought to be, and therefore the study of language ought to be externalist, too. But this is just a misinterpretation of the work. And you can see that very clearly if you look at the experiments. The experiments don't involve cubes rotating in space. They involve tachistoscopic images. So, you know, the standard experiment would be you got a tachistoscope in which there's a bunch of points of light, and the question is what different arrays of points of light will lead to a person seeing a cube rotating in space. And there's all kinds of theories about that. Turns out that if you have 4 points of light and you give them, and I forget how many, I think 3 successive presentations, that determines a rigid object rotating in space. Your mind does all the rest of the work. It just takes the successive points and forces an interpretation of a rigid object. There's some kind of rigidity principle in your head that says, however limited the stimulation, and it can be very limited, interpret it as a rigid object moving in space, not as some other thing. That's, in fact, one of the big discoveries. But the discovery was not made by having people look at objects rotating in space. It was made by points of light flashing on a tachistoscope, because it was, in fact, only interested in the relation between the retinal image and the brain. People have been misled by the fact that in the kind of informal discussion where there's efforts to motivate what they're doing, there's a lot of talk about functional utility and evolution and, you know, how we might have gotten this way and so on. And, of course, all of that talk is externalist. It talks about how people, you know, function in the world. But when you get to the actual experimental work, it's all completely internalist, and as far as I can see, it has to be. There's no way to do externalist psychology. Externalist psychology would be a study of everything. You know, it would have to include physics and chemistry and everything else. That's not a topic. You know, that's like, why do things happen again? So there's no way to do externalist psychology, and in fact, nobody does it. They do internalist psychology. They may describe it in ways that mislead people, maybe even mislead themselves, but there's no possibility of doing it. Now, are things different when we turn to the special branch of psychology that studies language? Well, let's have a look at the arguments. Notice again before proceeding that if there is an internalist account of perceiving a cube rotating in space, as there is, then we don't look for an externalist account, because the internalist account carries no burden of proof. It's strictly part of science. It's obviously far simpler. It doesn't require, you know, the study of trees, let's say. And it's a prerequisite again. You can't develop the externalist account without some account of what happens between the retina and the eye. I mean, even if you were interested in studying the relationship between trees and percepts, somewhere along the way you'd have to study what goes on between the retina and percepts. So the internalist account is surely a prerequisite, I mean, obviously, in this case. Therefore, it wins. And since it works anyway, there's no further interest in externalist psychology. Exactly the same as in the
social factors aspect of this.
Well, let's turn to the
perception.
Yeah, you can call it. That's what it actually is. I mean, what's called visual psychology or psychology of perception is the study of brain processes. I mean, it's not the study of everything. You know. So, for example, if you have a real perception and an illusion, you'll give the same account of them. As far as psychology is concerned, I mean, you'll want to know why the you know, the Necker cube looks, provides an illusion. But, you know, that's an internalist account. What else could it be? So, for example, a psychologist studying visual perception is not going to carry out an inquiry into the nature of trees, because people see trees. And same across the board. Well, let's take a look at the special branch of psychology that studies language and ask whether there's any more sense to an insistence on real-world factors in reference and meaning in this case. Here the arguments, again, go back largely to Putnam and Kripke in that same collection of articles that I mentioned, which about 20 years ago really set the field on a new course. And incidentally, they have a lot of very, not only well-argued, but very useful material in them. They were quite important, although I don't agree with these particular conclusions. The standard argument, goes back to Putnam, is what's called the twin earth argument. I mean, that's like the paradigm around which the discussion proceeds. Suggests the following, he says, think of the following thought experiment. Okay, we on earth have a word, water. Let's pick a person who he calls Oscar. On earth has a word, water, and water refers to a particular thing which scientists have told us is H2O. Okay? So the word water refers to H2O.